Hello and welcome to the Second Row podcast. My name is Park Kelly and you will find me everywhere on social media at the Second Row. That's 2ND, not the word second. And with me all the way from New Zealand. And if it wasn't for the fact he's a day job, would still be celebrating Oisín Collins.
Hey, Borg, how we doing? I am, I'm in a better mood than I thought I'd be recording the end of tour podcast.
I think everyone is. It's just unreal how, is it just me or is that, did that just feel like it was destined to happen after that second test?
Well, it's funny because after the second test, I would no longer have been happy with the kind of glorious one win that you and I talked about a couple of weeks ago. I mean, we were good in that second test. Now, New Zealand were not good, but yeah, it was an interesting week between test two and test three. I was traveling through the South Island, chatting away to different Kiwi rugby fans who were giving it the whole, oh, you know, great that you guys won a game on the tour. That'll be good. That'll help, you know. Good for your development. It's a very different tone on Sunday.
And you must be laughing every single time you think of them now. Just like a little chuckle to yourself or that evil cackle that you hear Mr. Burns do.
Excellent. Yeah, it's been good. It's been a pretty special week.
Even if, like, I got a text message from you halfway through that third test going Mexican winning to the worst, just let me rant about it for 5 minutes. Like, I won't give you five, but you can go for it.
So, we all love a Mexican wave when we're sitting watching Zebre play the Cheetahs or the Southern Kings. Fine, absolutely. There's no rugby on the pitch to entertain you. But the amount of times that Mexican waves broke out during, like, some of the best test rugby that's been played in the last 2 years, in cities where no test rugby has been played in the last 2 years, was curious.
Yeah,
and that's all I'll do while I still live here.
It just feels like it's a bunch of people that weren't actually watching the match at all, you know.
At one point in Wellington, there were two different waves happening at the same time, chasing each other around the stadium while New Zealand were getting battered. Like, I couldn't believe it. I don't approve.
The thing is, when you're getting beat like that, it's easy to switch off. You got to make your own entertainment.
Yeah, maybe, but no. Disapprove. Unlike, unsubscribe.
All right, before we get into the three-test series, there was, like, other tests across the last couple of weeks, and we just kind of run through the kind of who won. I can't even remember the results, but England, as everyone knows, beat Australia in their 2-1 in their test series. South Africa beat Wales 2-1 in their test series. Argentina beat Scotland 2-1 in their test series. France beat Japan 2-0, and that second match last week was a cracker. So if anyone has time, go back and watch that. And I think the biggest result outside the New Zealand one is Chile qualifying for the first World Cup, beating USA over two legs.
Yeah, unbelievable result for Chile. Great to see them in the Rugby World Cup. It's kind of nice to see new teams come into the Rugby World Cup. The other huge result, of course, was Georgia beating Italy for the first time, which I'm sure is going to set off a load of who should be in the Six Nations chat, which is bad. But aside from that, you know, great for rugby that we're still seeing upsets and new teams coming to the fore.
And for all those people who are on that Georgia should be in the Six Nations World Cup, just remember when Italy joined, they'd beaten Ireland three times. They'd beaten Wales, Scotland, France, all in that couple of years beforehand. Now, do Georgia deserve more opportunities against Six Nations teams? Of course they do. That's not in question. Is a relegation playoff viable at the moment? No, it isn't. And that's the barrier, that's the gap that needs to be grown. For me, anyway.
Tell us what you really think, Borg.
Yeah, but the problem is like there just isn't the money in that second tier in Europe for a Six Nations team to survive if they get relegated. And that's actually the big killer. Because if Ireland had one bad year, that is Irish rugby bankrupt. Simple as.
Yeah, there's a question to be looked at in terms of scheduling to try and maybe look at during that international break. Do you have those games on a Thursday and a Friday night instead of on a Saturday, Sunday? Obviously, big impact on the live fans, but you know, what's the goal? If it's to create bigger TV audiences and more money, would having rugby 3 or 4 nights a week be better? Maybe there's a way to think a little bit more about it and make it work. But yeah, let's not open that can of worms now.
Yeah, and We'll step away from the 15s game just for a second, and both Irish sevens teams have qualified for the World Cup in South Africa next year.
Yeah, fantastic results, and I've unfortunately only seen the highlights, but yeah, just great to see that Irish sevens program really paying dividends, and great to see them both competing in the Rugby World Cup sevens.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's ever going to create real top tier 15s players, but I do think it should be an extra avenue for players in Ireland to go pro. And that's all players want, just more opportunities to go pro as much as possible and to get paid to do what they love for a living.
It's another avenue to grow the game, right? The maximum amount of good, competitive, professional contracts on offer, all good.
Exactly. Now, let's get on to 15s and let's talk about Ireland over New Zealand. 5 games, 3 wins. Just what a 3 weeks of rugby.
I mean, yeah, from game one in Hamilton against the Maori, there was a sense of occasion, and boy, did the tour live up to its billing. I mean, it's been years, it's nearly, I think, 10 years since Ireland played down here, since we had a test against the All Blacks. It certainly felt like it, because everywhere you went, the top news story every day, you know, hours of talk radio were being dedicated to this tour. The guys down here have, it's TAB, which is, you know, we would see those ads and think, oh, Paddy Power exists here too. And some of the biggest, like, poking fun at, sideways look at ads you've ever seen. Like, after the first week, it was I thought you were pretty good, huh, Ireland? And then the second week they had, there's still a week to go, everybody calm down. So it's been really funny kind of having the whole country vibe around this. Like, I'm talking about 30-foot billboards in major cities being dedicated to a match that's on at the weekend. But no, it's been all anybody's been talking about, Pádraig. It's been fantastic.
It's great. And those Maori games, like the first one up in Hamilton, they set the tone of what to expect, because the Irish team were, you could see they're told to go out there and play like the test team that are going to start on the Saturday. And the Maori team were almost set up how the main New Zealand team are set up, like to just attack when they mess up. That's all you have to do and you'll score points. And in the first test, you kind of see that.
Yeah, I think there was a big emphasis from both Maori games, and in particular the second test, on playing on-ball rugby, right? You look at the amount of times that test teams generally kick the ball away to create pressure or to get territory. And certainly in that first half of that second game, I think I was counting, and TJ Perenara maybe kicked the ball twice. Whereas, you know, New Zealand weren't getting over the gain line. And in particular, in that second test, the combinations for Ireland were a little bit more rehearsed. They'd been in camp a little bit longer. They weren't super jet lagged. That can't hurt. And New Zealand just weren't able to use the kind of raw physical force to get over the gain line the way they were doing in Hamilton. The other side of it was, you know, in Hamilton, we were getting sliced apart. You know, Sean Stevenson, Zaren Sullivan had some of the best games of, certainly that I've seen them play. They were able to find so much space around the edge of that Irish defence, you know, turning transition opportunities into 7-pointers. And we just didn't give them those opportunities in Wellington in the second Maori test. It was really impressive.
I think between the two tests, in the first test, there was a try scored where Coombs and Prendergast led the defensive line. And they were just too far apart. They weren't together. Coombs had gone shot ahead out of Prendergast. It was a pass and suddenly New Zealand had scored 7 points. But at the second test, there was another kick. And they were the first two, once again, in that line. But they were connected. They're shoulder to shoulder. Their spacing was perfect. And that's the learning you want from a team that were facing the Maoris to take. You needed them to have a second test so they could make that learning. Like I said, the connection of defence was much better. Their attacking shape was brilliant. Now, was it perfect? No. I do think some of our kicking along the tram lines let the Maoris into the game in the second test and the first test, because that's where they got a lot of points. But that's where Ireland improved, and that's where you kind of see these guys are growing in camp. These guys are learning in the Irish camp, and that's what you want. I say from the Maori game, I think Ireland have a good 5 to 7 guys who, if not straight away, can step up into the senior team, are definitely well bedded in the systems that they won't feel like a huge drop off.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that question because, you know, looking at some of those players, I think Treadwell in the second test was outstanding. I mean, I wasn't sure. I kind of couldn't remember if he was already kind of logged onto that bench spot, but he was an absolute lock for me. He was going to go straight into any game and be a comfortable starter. Again, all the funnier because, as we briefly chatted about over the tour, you know, he's not even starting for Ulster in the big kind of, you know, top level games. I thought Gavin Coombs was exceptional. I thought his ball carrying, his general physical presence was outstanding. I thought Cian Prendergast showed a lot of endeavour. I thought he showed a lot of energy. I tell you, the big player who, for me, has taken the biggest step up in this tour, Kieran Frawley, in a sentence I can't believe I'm saying, looked all the more of a replacement for Johnny Sexton than anybody else in an Irish jersey has in years.
Yeah, and there's big questions, and I kind of opened a can of worms when I said this after the Maori game, of what do Leinster and Ireland do with Frawley? Because if they stick him in the 22 jersey for Leinster, that's him playing 12 and 10 whenever. Or does he now usurp Harry Byrne as the 10? That's usurping Ross Byrne. They have too many players and not enough jerseys. There's a discussion there that needs to be had.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some great analysis from, you know, the usual suspects, you know, Tom Savage on Three Red Kings and Squidge Rugby on his YouTube channel. But talking about the difference between when Ireland plays Johnny Sexton at 10 and not Johnny Sexton at 10, whether that's Harry Byrne, whether that's, you know, Kieran Frawley, whether it's Billy Burns. Kieran Frawley seems to be, certainly from a physical makeup, the closest to Johnny Sexton in that he's big, he's capable of being a physical inside ball carrying threat. But I was just surprised at the improvement in his composure between the first and the second Maori test. Like, really kind of controlled the game in a makeshift backline with Stuart McCloskey, who got there 2 to 3 days ago. Keith Earls, who was played out of position at outside centre and I think probably had the worst performance of his tour playing out of position, a couple of really sloppy passes that you know, had me shouting, wingers can't pass at the telly. But yeah, I thought Kieran Frawley did really well to navigate that. I thought he was really impressive. And Craig Casey stepped up big time as well inside him.
Yeah, and I think when we talk about what Ireland do in the future, I think Craig Casey's going to be quite central to that because he is more like a French nine. He shouts, he controls, he moves people around. And if we don't have, as I call it, the psychopathic tendency at 10 that Johnny Sexton has, we might need that from our nine. And he seems to be kind of built like that.
That makes sense. I mean, he's somebody who has just got future captain written all over him, you know, whether that's club level or international level. The guy seems to really benefit from having that leadership pressure on his shoulders. Whereas, as we both know, sometimes that can really damage a player. They can shrink from it. But he loves it. You know, tiny man picking fights with giant Maori second rows. There's nothing better.
No, it's great to see. And it's what I think a lot of Irish fans want to see, is that younger generation stepping up and being counted. And if you look across the Maori game, I think the pack all did that, you know, especially the back row all stood up. They all were counted. They all like, no, we deserve our spot on this team. We're going to grab hold of the next jersey that's given to us and make it ours. And that's what you want to see from all those players.
Yeah. And a couple of words, you know, Jeremy Lockman, after having a really miserable first test, stepped up his game, had a good performance in the second test. Thought Tom O'Toole was pretty consistent throughout. Timoney was pretty consistent throughout. One player who actually, I think, possibly did put a mark in his copybook over the Maori games was McCarthy, who I really thought, you know, his decision-making in the second test was pretty diabolical.
Yeah, like, he does bring a physicality and he does bring, you know, all those things you want from a second row. It just doesn't have the brain for it yet. That'll come with time. But for me...
Well, he is literally 11 years old based on that photo that was published with Cian Prendergast.
The two of them look like they're backpacking around the country and were asked to play a match.
Absolutely, like, does anybody have boots?
But the biggest winner for me actually from the Maori games was Niall Scannell. Coming in how he did and performing how well he did, especially how he hasn't had a great season with Munster. I think that's one of the big takeaways of how he stepped up and improved in the space of a couple of weeks improved his level off over the course of the year, not improved as a player. That's the guys who stepped up is the big takeaway.
So Noss Cannell has got an eye on that third spot at the World Cup. He wants Rob Herring's jersey, and he did himself no harm. He needs another big year. He needs another kind of year like he had when he got into the Ireland squad in the first stage, maybe 4 or 5 years ago for Munster. But it's there for him to get.
Yeah, that's the jersey he's fighting for. And to be honest, it's going to be a hard fight because Rob Herring is that perfect type of third hooker you have in a squad for me. I think he's kind of got the very much an all-around game. It's not as explosive as the Sheehans or Kelleher's of the world, but he's that type of guy you'd like to have there and available. And he's got the experience to boot.
Solid and a lot of minutes under his belt. Yeah, know what you mean.
Right, now let's talk about the big ones, the big three tests.
Oh, but before we do, sorry, I want to talk about before we leave this, that tackle, like Sean Stevenson on Mike Lowry, felt like it should have been illegal because I don't know how Mike Lowry wasn't like cut in actual half by it.
I'm pretty sure Lowry's ribs were in his back by the end of the game because of it.
I think they might have been planted in the ground underneath him. I mean, isn't that just one of the best tackles that you have seen, though?
Oh, it was unreal. And like it just proves that you can hit someone short and you can hit them hard while getting low.
Sean Stevenson's about 6'2", I think.
And Mike Lowry's about 5'1".
Exactly. It was like when Treebeard in The Lord of the Rings went down and picked up one of the hobbits, except, you know, Pippin is still on the ground trying to figure out if his lungs are inside his body or not.
Yeah, it was a great tackle, and I think it's a concrete moment that proves that you can get low, and it's just fatigue and poor coaching that makes those tackles so high.
Well, coming as it did between the second and third test with a player leaving the pitch for an upright tackle in both, you know, it should be, as I said when I tweeted it, this should be on a repeat video loop in every rugby stadium everywhere in New Zealand between now and the World Cup and in a few other countries too.
Yeah, including Ireland. Like, you know, it's every team, I think, has one of those red cards in their locker at the moment.
Yep.
It's just how can teams management reduce them as much as possible? And I think we'll talk about the cards when we get to the three other tests. But it's not going away anytime soon. And I think teams have to adjust quick.
And the expectations that there's some consistency, and we'll definitely get to that when we talk about test three. But yeah, let's start in Eden Park, where the All Blacks effectively defended their winning record in that stadium, shall we say.
Yeah, a 42-19 win, which I'm going to say this, that scoreline flatters the All Blacks.
It does, and it's almost entirely related to, you know, a 90-second period of the game from Ireland where Johnny Sexton, who either gets or is still, you know, just having been concussed, throws an ill-advised pass to Gary Ringrose, who slips and throws an even more ill-advised pass to James Lowe, who's not in position and slips, and then there's an intercept try. And Johnny Sexton goes off the pitch. By the time Ireland recover their composure, we're 21 points down and kind of shell-shocked.
I think you also have to put in the fact that we got held up over the line 5 times.
Yeah, like,
it's not as if we weren't attacking well or getting near the line. Like, we could have won that game if we just took our chances.
Well, and interestingly, and sorry to jump around a little bit, but if you look at Porter's try in the second test and Herring's try in the third test, I think we learned from that. You know, if there's a gap, you've got to go for it. You can't just, you know, ruck and ruck and ruck and pick and go and pick and go and hope to get over the line. If there is an opportunity to go over as Porter did or through as Herring did, you do it because the penalty of being held up over the line is too great and goal line defenses are just getting better and better.
Yeah, and for me, I have no problem with teams getting that dropout because you do have to reward a good defense in some way, shape or form, especially on the goal line. So if they can get the ball back or at least kick it back to you at the halfway line, they're getting some reward than just having a scrum and just keeping battered and battered and battered, because there's an air of inevitability about all that. Whereas at least the going dropout creates more scenarios, more interesting ball and play time anyway, to say the least.
Yeah, and it forces teams to actually take their chances, which is something that Ireland improved on through the three tests. Red zone efficiency. How many visits to the 22 do we have in that first test and came away with so few points?
It was actually kind of one of my biggest kind of challenges for the Irish management going forward. Because I do think we got better, but I don't think we're where we need to be to, I'm going to say the dreaded words, win a World Cup.
Well, it is interesting, though, and it's kind of one of my big conclusions from this tour, which we'll definitely talk about, is that's the goal, right? Like, this is not the team for the next 5 or 10 years. This is an 18-month project from now until a World Cup final.
Oh, definitely. Nothing about this test was saying we're planning for the future. This is the test of now. This is, and I think we're going to see that 23, give or take players for injuries, in every game between now and whatever stage of the World Cup we get to.
I mean, I imagine you hope we don't, given that you wanted Johnny Sexton to play less than 100 minutes this tour.
I did say 150.
I eventually walked you back to that, yeah. And I mean, and you kind of got that, but the concussion helped, eh?
But
the not a concussion helped.
Yeah, the not a concussion did like reduce his minutes to something like just over 160. The meaningful minutes at 10 for anyone that's not Johnny Sexton is an issue. But we're gonna wrap him up in cotton wool and bubble wrap and everything else we can do between now and the World Cup final, or the World Cup. Anyone from Leinster listening to this, you will only see Johnny Sexton for the Heineken Cup. And even then, it could be just a Heineken Cup knockout stages, and that'll be it.
And I mean, even then, if you get a hard draw. I mean, if you guys draw Harlequins, then Kieran Frawley is starting at 10.
But that's the problem. I think that's Leinster's problem then. Who's the 10? That, like, this year for Leinster is their year to actually christen their now new Johnny Sexton, their new 10. They have the prime time to do that, and it will help Ireland as well.
Well, they've got plenty to choose from, so just gonna have to pick somebody.
That's never been a Leinster problem. It's
yeah, true. We're from the deprived west of Ireland, we have a different view of the world, eh?
Oh no, we have too many players wanting too much game time. Tough.
I do vaguely recall some articles about Munster's 5 halfbacks and 4 tens and whatever else. So, you know, and glass houses.
And still only playing 2 of them.
Maybe. What did impress me was Ireland's ability to get better game on game. You think about the way that the All Blacks moved the ball around in that first test. They were passing much wider than we expected, and they were getting outside the defensive line. We had completely neutralized that by test two. We weren't getting over the gain line in the first test. We changed how aggressive we were when we got within 5 meters in the second test. We didn't take our points when we needed to in the second test, and we did in the third test. So it actually, for me, was really pleasing to see the team learning on their feet.
And not only game to game, but in game. Because first test, we were much better in the second half than we were in the first half. Second test, much better in the second half than we were in the first half, especially after that weird 20-minute period before halftime.
Much more clinical in that second half, for sure.
And in the third test, when the All Blacks had their purple patch and came out swinging, not only did we hold them off, not only did when the All Blacks scored their tries, we're like, actually, hold on a second, we just need to score now and put this to bed. I mean, what do? We go up the pitch, we get a try, we put the game to bed.
You talk about that purple patch. It's almost always for the All Blacks just before halftime. And I was watching that game in Wellington thinking, we've got to hold the line. We've conceded late tries in the first test and the second test in the first half. Holding them to nothing, like holding them to 3 points in that first half was just the psychological equivalent of like chopping their arms and legs off. Yes, they came out and yes, they scored pretty quickly in the second half. But that felt like a death rattle. More than it felt like a comeback.
I think, yes, they came out in the second half. I think, yes, Savea and Jordan came out in the second half, because them two alone, I think, single-handedly dragged New Zealand forward in that third test. And to their point,
they might be the only two players I'd take.
At the moment, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, they're exceptional, though. They really are just wildly talented.
And for Will Jordan's try, I could actually see him breaking into camera screen going, he's going to score a try. Before he even got the ball, I just knew the pace he was getting that ball at. He was hitting the line in such a place that I knew, well, that was a try being scored, given how everything was happened.
When you spotted that it was Sexton defending the centre of the backfield, and I could see like the freeze frame in there. It was at this moment that they knew they had messed up.
I think Will George just wants to pay him back for like him buying that ridiculous dummy Johnny Sexton did in the first half.
Oh, that was so good. I mean, he was probably just still looking for him after the dummy in the first half.
It's the Lurling game on game, half on half, is the biggest thing to say about this coaching team as well. It's how they're able to impart information in a quick turnaround that improves the team.
I think it's really interesting. It almost seems like they're coaching with absolutely no ego, in that if they've messed up in the first half, they're like, okay, well, let's do something different. If it didn't work in the first game, they're like, okay, well, what didn't work? What can we do better? Whereas when you compare that to the All Blacks management, where Foster has essentially been part of the management of this team, you know, since the last World Cup, how does he go, oh no, everything is wrong, I need to rip it up and start again? Because he wrote everything they're doing.
Well, the problem for me is watching the All Blacks. Their plan off will line up across a pitch, someone will punch a hole, and then someone will do something magic. Just isn't good enough anymore.
No, consistently Ireland were the team creating opportunities, occasionally creating them for the All Blacks, but we were the ones doing all the creating work. And as you said, the All Blacks were just waiting on one of the Barretts or Artie Savea or Brody Retallick to just create something out of nothing and then trusting their ability to capitalise. And our smother defence was too good. Our general defence was too good for most of the three tests.
The second New Zealand got into past phase 3, 4, 5, Ireland looked comfortable. Yes, we might have been going back, but it was going back at two yards, but we're still connected in defence. We weren't being pulled left, right, over and back, and space being created, because all we had to do was number up. There was nothing happening in New Zealand's attack to kind of pull us apart. Whereas if you look at the try that Robbie Henshaw got in the third test, we just manipulated the All Blacks defence like they were children.
That was unbelievable. I mean, you could genuinely see the hamster stop turning in a couple of the defenders' heads, where they just went, wait, where's he? How's he got the... But, oh no! And then he's just under the posts. It was a staggeringly good try.
Like, I was there.
But we created opportunities like that through the second test as well. Like, our ability to run those kind of almost multi-phase screen runner moves, but after 2 to 3 to 4 phases of possession, it's incredible. It's almost like we can reset and start a set piece from wherever we want at the moment.
But that's the thing. If you look at Hugo Keenan's try in the third test, that's what happened. Hanson came in and took over as 10 and went down the short side. And that's the difference. Why everyone focuses on Johnny Sexton so much, and him being a beacon of, like, he does all the play, it has now given license to the more creative elements outside him that can kind of step in and go, actually, hold on a second, this has gone down this side. Stepping in and moving the ball. And that's what we've needed.
I tell you what, that third test team looked really balanced. I thought, you know, for as good as Gary Ringrose can be, I thought this was a poor series from him. And, you know, Bundy had an incredible series in all of the games he featured in. But him and Robbie Henshaw continue to just ask, why wouldn't you pick these two?
So here's my thing. And you're going to roll your eyes because you know what I'm going to say. They are the best centre partnership.
Robbie's not a 12. Robbie's a 13.
Yeah, all that type of stuff. And anytime I say that on Twitter, I get a few...
Dogs abuse.
I get abuse saying, like, Ringrose is great. I am not saying Ringrose is not a quality 13. I'm saying as a partnership, as the combined unit, Robbie at 13 with Bundy inside him just works better than Robbie at 12 and Ringrose inside him. As we've seen that sometimes Bundy at 12 with Ringrose outside him works better than Robbie at 12 and Ringrose outside him.
Yep.
There'll be times it's horses for courses selections. I get that.
Yeah.
But I think if we're in a World Cup semi-final final tomorrow, I don't see how Bundy and Robbie are starting that.
not off the back of this tour, where genuinely they just looked the most balanced, the most connected in defence, the most capable in attack. And I think the wings are going to be interesting too, because for me, until that third test, James Lowe had a really, really poor tour. And even in that third test, I feel like he was comprehensively outplayed by Hansen.
I'm just going to add in one question I got here asking about the tests in general, because I put up a shout out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you fell off a roof, is there anyone you trust more than Mac Hansen to catch you? And
or anybody you trust less than Jameson Gibson Park?
The thing is, I think Hansen had a great series, two tests, and he just... Has someone ever, in the space of 12 to 18 months, just looked like, how is this guy this good, this quick? And I listen to the Rugby Report Card guys a lot. Like, you know, we like the guys from Australia. Right. And they are constantly going, how did we let this guy go? You know, and you can see why they'd be asking that question, because he's just, I think he's everything we've wanted in our non-hard running winger.
He's genuinely just so comfortable. He looks like, to me, it's the same as watching Craig Casey pull on a green jersey. He looks like he's been playing test rugby for years. Like, he's got 40, 50 caps. It's astonishing how comfortable he is at that level.
And by the thing I would mean by comfortable is that he looks like he always has too much time on the ball. Doesn't matter if he's being tackled or he's a couple of yards away from the gain line. He always looks like he is working out that math in real time. And he goes, I have so much time here. It's okay.
Yeah. And he's, I mean, I know you had mentioned a couple of times his defense was not bad, but possibly one of the weaker elements of his game. He was really consistent and really safe back there, both on high ball, kick defense, but also just shutting down the channel.
I think once he's used to those around him, I'll go back to some of his first caps in Connacht, where you could actually see him looking for the defenders around him in game one. Then game three, he just knew where he was meant to be. And I think that's the same with Ireland. First game, he might be like looking around him, but the second he does reps and knows his role, because he seems to learn so quickly, that he's just comfortable. And for me, over the course of five games, of all the wingers, the biggest, like, I call them winners, out of the guys who have come out with a lot of credit from this tour, from the wingers' perspective, like Hansen, obviously, but also the guys who are at home, Stockdale, Conway, Balakoon. Like, I don't think Lowe cemented his place in that jersey. I don't think the guys in the Maori games kind of said, we're the next guys to step up.
It was good to see Jordan Larmour back on a rugby pitch again, but... You know, we were a group of us who were down at the second test were out for dinner, and we saw Jordan Larmour and Kieran Frawley and somebody else queuing outside the restaurant. And just like the test team, they didn't get in there either. So I don't know whether that was, you know, just easier because we had a reservation, but they just haven't made that step up. Yeah, we'll see. But before we get into kind of winners and losers, we kind of have to talk about the discipline issue, right?
Yeah, I think we'll talk about the cards in general at a later stage, but New Zealand can't handle losing at all. They just lose the head quicker.
Being under that kind of pressure, the All Blacks are a team who will put a hit on you, right? I mean, some of the interviews with Dalton Papali'i before the second game talked about, you know, wanting to go out and make hits and make his presence felt, you know, the haka is there to intimidate. It's there as a show of physical strength and force, as well as it's a cultural recognition thing. And they've really just fell on the wrong side of the referee in test two and test three to a degree. The penalty count was off the charts, and chipping, you know, two yellows and a red card in one game is almost unheard of at international level.
And in test two, because I'll talk about the cards for New Zealand in test two. So, the card for Fainga Anuku should have been a red. I think that's reckless enough that it kind of negates the slight hand to the chest that Mac Hansen got first. But I don't think that was the winning and the losing of the game. And the second, that red card for the hit on Gary Ringrose, who, you know, let's not forget, took him out the third test.
Yeah, ended his tour.
Yeah. Like, that was a red. And if you look at the Ireland match, I got to say, I think Porter's lucky to have only seen yellow. I think Bundy as well is lucky to still to have stayed on the pitch.
So I didn't see the Bundy incident you were on about, but yeah, I think Porter very lucky. I mean, he basically shattered Brody Retallick's eye socket, which is not what you would typically call in safe terms, you know, player safety and all that. But the refereeing distinction, as I understand it, again, was at the game, didn't hear it, was Andrew Porter made a passive tackle because Brody Retallick was still moving forward. That's a cop-out, right? If you're trying to get tackle height down, get tackle height down. Penalise it with a degree of consistency. They're both yellows or they're both reds. Pick which it is and apply the rule.
Here's the thing. For Wayne Barnes, that's a consistent call because he did the exact same thing in the Gallagher Premiership. Now, it was a scrum half doing it, not a prop.
Yeah, did anybody leave with their face mashed in?
I think so. I think it would lead to a HIA.
No. Look, I think World Rugby does have to get across this, and they made some pretty, you know, strong, if snarky, remarks after the second test. But looking at this as it is as a lead-up to the World Cup, where you've got a much broader standard of game, much broader standard of coaching and refereeing, they've got to get super consistent about this, because otherwise it's not going to drive the behaviours that they want. Think about the reaction to tip tackles. Think about the reaction to challenges in the air. That changed how the game was played. And that's what they're trying to do with the tackle height. And they've just got to be consistent.
And the thing is, if you look at how the game's being reffed across the hemispheres, so the Six Nations teams in South Africa in comparison to Australia and New Zealand, and the challenges of rugby is different in both sets of countries, to the point where I think World Rugby need to kind of talk to Australia and New Zealand and go, look, if you've got a hemorrhage people and fans to rugby league, fine, but get in line.
Yeah, either way, the rules have to apply the same to everybody, because that's the only thing that will change behaviours.
And I think they need to be simplified across the board, because
that would be nice.
Like, think of the 12 men in test one, think of the 12 men in test two. That all that stuff, it's just got to be simplified. Like, someone who watches their first game of rugby needs to be able to explain something within 10 seconds, not 10 minutes.
I have no interest in trying to bring a scientific calculator to the match to figure out how many players are supposed to be on the pitch.
And we're two people who love rugby and love the intricacies and love the little bits around the breakdown and all those things that, you know, that make teams smarter. Like,
I said the phrase red zone efficiency not 30 minutes ago. I am clearly not the punter.
Exactly. And even we're like, oh my God, I should not need a 15 box spreadsheet to figure out how many players should be on the pitch. It's sometimes rugby gets in its own way, where they try and tweak a law instead of going, let's just remove that and rewrite it and be done with it.
Yep, agreed. All right, let's talk winners and losers. Who was your kind of standout couple of players from the tour?
For me, I think the Irish back row in general were incredible. Peter O'Mahony, especially in that second test, was just God mode. I think is the correct term. Like, his third test wasn't as impactful, but if you look at every single ruck or breakdown, and he had one great maul turnover, there he is being a nuisance. I think Tyke Byrne, that especially that final 20 minutes he was playing in the third test, just I'm not sure, but I actually think he brought the ball with him to the game. And he wanted to make sure that no one would take it home afterwards. I'm pretty sure that's how he played.
Watching Ty Byrne, he's got this kind of a mode that he goes into in the last 10 or 15 minutes of a game that really matters, where he's just unplayable. I think he got 3 turnovers in the last 10 minutes he was on the pitch against New Zealand in that third test, which is ridiculous. Peter Manny, incredible tour. I kind of feel bad. I actually wasn't sure he'd make the test team. I wasn't sure if the Irish, you know, management was going to continue picking him. I wasn't sure if they should, because he hasn't had a vintage season for Munster. But he was just awesome.
He's actually going to get an operation in the off-season. He's going to get his eyesight changed, so everyone he plays against wears a black jersey. And so his performance will stay at that level for the next year or to 18 months.
I thought it was going to be an operation to remove himself from the head of all disgruntled Leinster fans.
That too. Look, speaking of Leinster though, Van der Vlier, how is his standard that good? That's consistently that good?
Van der Vlier was amazing. His work rate is second to none. His tackle count is amazing. I don't know if you noticed, he's really improved his carrying.
Has that been mentioned before? I don't think that's ever been mentioned.
I think he's really working on his carrying. he's become a force in that team on and off the ball. I think the way Ireland use him as the nine off line-out work, given that he actually has the ability to pass back to a 10 or to another forward, means you can do that without, you know, kind of giving away that it has to be a maul. He's just such an all-round player. And I think he might have played all three tests for 80 minutes.
Yeah.
What an engine.
And the thing is, he works better with Peter O'Mahony at six.
Agreed. And it balances out stuff like the line out because Peter O'Mahony is such a force there. And he can kind of just make the tackles. And but particularly with O'Mahony and Byrne on the pitch, you kind of have two active threats at the breakdown, two rucks after another. You're not forcing Van der Vlier to go in and do that, which you might be if you had like a Doris Conan 6-8 combination where Van der Vlier then will have to lean into that part of the game.
Yeah. Like for me, if Peter O'Mahony was injured for a test, I'd be putting Byrne at six and Henderson at Ryan in the second row. I still think we need that balance off in the back row of someone being able to be a groundhog. And imagine having Byrne having a less attritional game, how much damage he could do across the full 80.
I don't think anybody else wants to think about that, but I find that quite exciting.
I know. Who else stood up for you?
So I think a word for Johnny Sexton at 37, still putting in, you know, potential player of the year performances, you know, world player of the year performances. He was exceptional, just really, really good. And not in the, you know, the conductor sits at the back and kicks the corners type of a way. He was getting stuck in. He put in some big hits. It was one when New Zealand were camped on the line with maybe 15 minutes to go, 10 minutes to go in the last test, and we powdered their scrum. But then Johnny Sexton came up and drove Fakatava back 5 full metres. You can see how much it still means to the guy and the level of performance he's still able to put in. He'll be sore, I'm sure, but he is the most important player to Irish rugby right now and will be until the World Cup.
It's fine. He's not going to play until December again, so he has time to recover. But if I'm being honest, I think there was a news article that went out over here saying, is Johnny Sexton de facto Ireland's greatest rugby player at this stage?
Ever or right now? Because right now, absolutely he is.
The question is, he's overtaken Bod as the best ever.
I think probably the most important ever. I mean, it's interesting because you hear O'Driscoll and he's always talked about it. It was always the three O's, right? It was O'Driscoll, O'Gara and O'Connell who were all there all at the same time. If you look at Johnny Sexton in terms of his longevity, how long he's been in the game and how long he's been that important to Leinster and Ireland, I would certainly argue he's been Ireland's most important player in the modern era.
Yeah, definitely. I think given how we're set up at the moment, he's definitely the most important. We'll wait until he retires to see is he the best ever, full stop. That's a discussion for other people. But
let's not write anybody's obituary just yet, shall we?
And let's not get my mentions all riled up either. So
yes, indeed. I thought Sheehan had a good tour, actually. I hadn't seen a huge amount of his rugby. He's the understudy to Kelleher, but some of the physicality, some of the carrying he was taking to the line was really impressive.
But you can clearly tell he's worked on his carrying in such a way where he doesn't rely on his physicality. His footwork before contact is incredible. He's always finding a soft shoulder. I still think Kelleher comes in when he's fit again, but I think Sheehan's made that a much harder discussion.
Who else? Winners? I think we talked about some of the guys from the extended squad. Treadwell for me. Excellent tour, really, really, really strong. Casey, really good tour. Coombs and Frawley, probably the standouts for me.
Yeah, I'd actually say one of the biggest winners or even surprises was Doris. I think he's had that level of performance in him for a while, but he just hasn't been, and I mean this literally, holding onto the ball enough.
yeah. But, unbelievable second test. I think a little slow in the first test and hard not to be, but outplayed by Savea in the third test, man-to-man, but definitely getting close to the level of performance that, you know, he was touted as coming into.
Yeah, and if he can build on that or use that as his baseline, I think himself and Coombs are going to be battling for that 8 jersey. I think Coombs will need to find an extra layer two to his game to displace Doris now. But because before this, you could make a real argument for Coombs just taking over the jersey.
Yeah, I think it's game on. That's, you know, you often see competition brings the best out of players. I think Coombs versus Doris for that 8 shirt could be an absolutely cracking outcome. And that's before we mention Jack Conan, you know, starting number 8 for the Lions.
Yeah, there's quality and depth across the back row.
Yeah, and I think we'll talk about what next for New Zealand and then what next for Ireland.
Yes, Grant.
Yeah.
Right, so losers. I think, are we at losers? We are really, aren't we?
Yeah.
So that's
the good stuff. Who will be looking back on this tour as a missed opportunity?
I think, like, through no fault of his own, Harry Byrne, he got injured and that's it. That was his tour done, you know, in essence. And I think Joey Carberry, that might be harsh, but I think one intercept aside, what really did he do across the three tests?
Yeah, I think a better cameo in test 3 than anything we saw in the first two tests, but has done nothing to secure his place in the Ireland squad, or actually his starting place in the Munster squad. He's someone who now has to go have a seriously big year.
Yeah, because like you were saying, because we've talked about this before, you think Ben Healy should have been starting the bigger games for Munster last season. And I doubt there's many Munster fans that would disagree with you, to be honest.
Well, again, if you think about the Ireland picture, Ben Healy, again, is closer to that Johnny Sexton archetype than Joey Carberry is. So if you're thinking about the provinces being a feeder system for the national side, we can either restructure our entire game plan for the post-Johnny Sexton world, or we can start picking tens at a provincial level who model that type of game plan.
Yeah, and I think in the medium term after the World Cup, I think Jack Carty's that perfect 1 to 2 years, because he's got that sycophantic, psychopathic element to his game as well, and he doesn't shirk away defensively. He's physical. He brings the ball to the game line. Yes, he has the 1 in 99 kicks that goes wrong, and that's the one thing he'll have to work on. But being the number one guy suits him. And
yeah,
being told you're my guy, even if it's for 2 years, we'll get Ireland out of a hole if no one else steps up.
It's going to be an interesting period. But, you know, there's a couple of other windows in that team people can get into before the World Cup. We've said it, James Lowe, I don't think has really improved his stock. He's still going to be in and around the Irish setup, but by no means a nailed-on starter. Gary Ringrose wasn't great. Uncharacteristically poor, I would say.
The thing is, I wouldn't say he was poor. He just wasn't good. And I know it's a very slight difference. He was just average. You know, he didn't play poorly. Nothing he did was bad. He just didn't play well. Mm. And I think that's a big thing. A lot of players played well. No one played like drains and no one played badly. But the thing is, those average performances look worse in comparison to people playing well.
The other one, which again is, it's so frustrating to see given how good I know he is, James Ryan, particularly in the first and second test, just never seemed at the pace and at that level of physicality and impact that you expected. Step up in the third test, similar to Lowe, but test 1 and 2 were not good.
No, like I agree. He wasn't what we expect of him. He seems to be getting there again as he's tweaked his game. What's doing him a disservice is being the line-out caller. I think when Henderson playing, that covers that. It takes away from his game being everything to everyone. And when I think the Irish manager need to focus in on his strengths and create the game plan for him where he can do that. And I think that's where Henderson coming in helps, because he takes some of that mental workload off him.
I think so, but right now Henderson takes Ryan's spot.
Definitely.
Yeah. Look, it was a good tour, and, you know, one of the biggest losers.
Let's not complain. Like, you know, we've won a tour series in New Zealand for the first time ever.
There's not supposed to be a bunch of poor performers. On the New Zealand side, you know, just to give you a bit of the flavor of what's going on around here, the management is probably the biggest loser of all. I was listening to a 3-hour phone-in on Wellington local radio on Sunday morning, where caller after caller after caller was baying for blood, like really disappointed and really frustrated and hacked off with the New Zealand rugby management team. And not the coaching team, but with the management team who appointed them and who let it get to this stage. Sam Kane is getting no Christmas cards this year. So, you know, I think there's questions to be answered. And while it's summer rest for Ireland now, New Zealand have to gee themselves up to go to South Africa and play the world champions in 3 weeks.
It's going to be interesting how that all develops. I do think that New Zealand have an issue in their attack and defence that can be fixed. It's just, can people get out their own way to fix it?
It's hard to bring in fresh ideas when you've been part of that setup for so long. Whether it's a case of Joe Schmidt stepping in and taking some involvement and kind of minimising Foster's involvement, or whether it's a case of Scott Robertson being asked to come in and do a job as a kind of an attack coach under Foster going into the World Cup. It's hard to see how it'll play out, but you know, one genuine thing that a lot of the Kiwi fans were staggered by, it is like written in stone tradition that the day after a game, there's a conference at the New Zealand team hotel. They cancelled it. Didn't turn up at all.
That's saying something.
Well, I think what it's saying to me is they didn't have any answers to give anybody. Yeah. And that's not the place you want to be coming into the Rugby Championship and a year out from a World Cup.
All right, that's enough about New Zealand's woes. And let's talk about what Ireland, not need to work on, but like what challenges would that management face going forward?
So I think what they've kind of shown is that there's 20 to 23 players nailed on for the World Cup. There's a handful of others, but we've kind of demonstrated that even with a small squad, we can play, you know, almost two separate teams. And given the Rugby World Cup is going to be in France, we can afford to do that because we can bring players out in case of injury. So I think Ireland are going to have an A team and a B team coming into Rugby World Cup 23. And on the B team, there's places up for grabs, you know, because we're not going to be able to put out Johnny Sexton for 80 minutes of every game and Peter O'Mahony for 80 minutes of every game. But it also doesn't feel like we're going to mix and match seniority in and out of our match day team, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like the big issue for the Irish management is integrating and making everyone feel like they're part of the end goal. And that they can break into the starting 23 if it's going that way, because it's very easy for that to turn sour if they don't.
True, but I actually think Ireland are nearly taking a bet on that and saying, you know what, guys, unless somebody's injured, you're not getting into the 23, but it takes all of us to get to a World Cup final. And you know what? The players who do well to get us there are going to be in the starting Six Nations next time around. And that is a risky, high-octane bet. But that's what this tour tells me Ireland are prepared to do. I mean, yeah. You can't tell me that anybody from that Maori game genuinely was going to get into the starting 23 for the last test, can you?
No. And to be honest with you, I think that was never going to happen this tour. And I think, yes, there are a couple of things to work on. But look, we improved the scrum. That needs to happen. The line out is a bit of an issue, but we'll work on that. But at the end of the day, we beat New Zealand back to back in New Zealand. The first time any team has done that in 24 years. That's incredible. I think that should just be celebrated. And as Ireland go through a heat wave, just enjoy the heat wave, enjoy the wave of good feeling that's going to bring.
Look, it's celebration time. The team were out enjoying all of Wellington's festivities late into the night on Saturday.
Mind your chicken, people.
Yeah, Bundy is coming. It's such a good buzz. I was I didn't make it into the office today, but everybody's been very gracious. They're annoyed at themselves. They're not annoyed at us. But I am going to enjoy wearing a green shirt into work tomorrow.
That's a great place to finish. Let's celebrate. Oisin, thank you so much for coming on and giving me the New Zealand perspective.
It's been a pleasure, Borg. It was a great tour, but even better to talk about it with you. And I imagine it won't be long before you're back on promoting Connacht's new drive to the URC title next year.
That's it. I'll more than likely be back doing podcasts on Connacht Rugby in the new season. I'll definitely be writing articles as the season goes on. You don't forget to subscribe to the channel. That's the second row, 2ND, not the word second, where I am literally everywhere. So until you hear from me again, thanks everyone for listening. And Oisín, thanks for coming on.
No worries, Borg. Take care and come on, Ireland. Bring on the World Cup.